think we can move on to the cash.
I know we have a second.
Okay.
All right, we just completed 8 and 9. All right, we're at 10, educational presentation on cash overlay program.
Okay, great. So cash overlay is another operational efficiency I think we can gain, particularly as we're looking at the transition. So again, on page 2, we start off with session goals. So again, provide some education and background on what cash overlay is. In this case, we want to identify some policy considerations as well so that we constrain overlay capabilities to do what we want them to do because they can provide other services as well. And so we want to sort of ring fence that and make sure we have it scoped out appropriately. And then again, provide VARIS, provide us with specific directions going forward. So we can move ahead then to page 5. And the cash overlay concept really gets its naming from this idea that every portfolio has some portion of cash in it. And that cash over time results in a drag in performance. Drag meaning that it doesn't provide the returns that the rest of the portfolio is. And if you think about markets over long term, we expect them to go up. So holding that cash ends up being, in today's environment, about a 0% return. So it's underperforming the rest of the assets in the portfolio. And so cash overlay is a way of saying, okay, well, let's take that cash and get the exposure of the rest of the portfolio. But instead of actually going out and buying the securities directly, we're going to invest in futures. And futures, or forwards, are contracts that obligate the plan to buy the securities in the future at a price that is determined today, regardless of where that price is in the future. Thus, you get the economic impact of owning the stocks without the physical ownership of the stocks. And in fact, you can do it with a fraction of the money you need to buy the stock. So when you say, I want to buy $10,000 of the S&P 500, a futures contract is only going to require you to put up a much smaller amount, say $100. And then at settlement, at that predetermined date, you then have to pay up the rest. And you may choose to never settle. You may choose to take that contract and sell the contract and buy a new contract and what have you, so that you never actually reach a settlement date, but you always have that economic exposure within your portfolio.
How does that impact risk?
It increases the risk because it fully puts to work what cash is currently a very low volatility asset class and gets you that economic exposure of whatever asset classes you're getting in your futures or forward contracts. So it increases it.
Well, I would answer that slightly. It increases your volatility, your standard deviation.
Got it.
It provides you an operational tool. So to the extent that you are not deployed in accordance with long-term plans, this allows you an operational tool to get there at a lower cost. So it might decrease operational risk, but increase the standard deviation of the portfolio because you're at your target allocation.
And who's going to be deciding the future? Would that be the consultant advising us, or is that your team?
No, there are firms that specialize in this.
Overlay managers.
And again, we've got the fees we'll be paying, but that should offset it by what?
Yeah, these are very low cost types of engagements. Can you give some guidance on what these cost in aggregate?
I don't have a good number off the top of my head.
Okay.
I want to say like 15 basis points kind of number.
Yeah, and I think the last time I took a hard look at this, it was a little bit north of that, but that was probably 3 years ago. So these are pretty low-cost types of engagements. And keep in mind, you know, we're going to be using this to fill in along the way. And we'll talk about kind of the envisioned role at Cicera a little bit later on in the presentation, but it's there's a very specific set of roles that we would envision using it for today. There's a whole host of things you can do with these. What we have in mind is a pretty limited scope.
So the other part to that, whether it increases your risk, is that it is designed to align your risk with what you expected you would have when we did the asset allocation study.
Okay.
And because you have a cash position, anytime that cash gets beyond what we modeled, you're actually getting lower risk, less performance. Thus, you use a cash overlay to get you back to your target while maintaining that cash position.
If we went back to a 5% on money market funds world,
from where we are today, would you have any different recommendation?
Wow. Capital market assumptions for everything else would probably be a bit higher as well, though.
Yeah.
There'd still be that gap of...
We used to have that barbell where you had 5%, you know, and way out here at 30 years you had 6%, and in between it was lower.
Let me hold that question for a moment, only because what we started on page 5 is the introduction in terms of how cash overlay kind of came into existence. It's grown beyond that. And so I think as you see how it's grown beyond that, we may answer your question in a couple different ways depending on the situation and what we're trying to accomplish. Okay. Fair enough?
Sure.
Okay. So I think we can skip page 6. I think we just spoke about that. Page 7 I do think is important because there is this risk management component to this because we are using derivatives. Forwards and futures contracts are derivatives, and we just have the definition of derivatives. And basically, any time you don't actually own the asset, but you own something that depends on the pricing of that asset, you've created a derivative, meaning it, the value of what we're buying, the futures contract or the forward contract, derives its value from the underlying. Thus, it's a derivative. So that introduces the concept of leverage, because now we could have leverage in the plan. And we want to be careful about having leverage, and we want to think about that and make sure it's managed. And so we note that to mitigate the leverage component, we can just cap the notional exposure based on our current cash balance. This is a common practice. And then a little bit about forwards. So let's get into the types of strategies as better answer John's question. Nine. Outlines the five main types of use that cash overlay has come to take on. So cash equitization is the first one, where we're trying to get that cash employed to be more productive. Passive rebalancing and asset allocation is the second, because you think about this concept and you say, well, can't I just use futures and forwards to effectively rebalance my portfolio? I don't have to just look at cash. I can actually synthetically create my new portfolio. If I wanted to go from 60-40 portfolio to a 70-30 portfolio, I could employ one of these managers, have them use their futures forward contracts capabilities and create that. And in the meantime, I can think about how I want to buy and sell within my portfolio to eventually own the securities and be in that position. So this is passive rebalancing as a second tool. The third tool is duration matching, which is somewhat along the same lines. You have your fixed income portfolio, and some pension plans think about matching their duration of their fixed income to the duration of the liabilities. You can do that here as well. Volatility management, if you start thinking about how we can control the volatility, so kind of getting back to Gabe's question, maybe my risk is too low and I want to bump that up. Can I use these capabilities to do that? Yes. Or conversely, can I dial my volatility lower? Yes. And then active insights. And this is actually saying we can use these things to actually take views on the market and go after valuation discrepancies we think are out there. And we can do it really quickly and really cheaply. We don't have active management on what's being bought or sold on an individual security basis, but you can do it on an index level basis. So as you think about it, then there's a whole range of tool sets available. We wanted to constrain this discussion really to the top two. Cash equitization makes sense because it reduces cash drag and it can be done effectively. Passive rebalancing is important. Going back to our last discussion about how we have our current portfolio, we know what our future portfolio is, where we're going. There's some steps we can take quickly, short term, but then there's a lot of other things that'll take time to get to. Could we use a cash overlay manager to help us get the economic exposures we want sooner than later? I suspect you had something to say there, right?
No, I mean, just to echo Ed, this is a very inexpensive way of buying large blocks of economic exposure. Buying, selling, there's a lot you can do with it, but I mean, to my mind, the simplest example of what we can do with this that'll save us money is when we get the employer prepayments in July, a portion, right now, that money is put to work in physical securities pretty much over a very short period of time. Sometimes that money is then taken back out of those managers as we have capital calls and distributions. And certainly this would allow us some flexibility if we brought in $200 million, but we knew that there was $40 million in impending capital calls and distributions. We could buy an S&P 500 contract for that. We could basically buy exposure to the stock market without trading, having imposing the physical trading costs that we talked about in the prior presentation there. So it's a way of gaining some operational efficiencies and not being at the mercy of the liquidity of the marketplace when we need to be moving money.
Had you done this in third and fourth quarter 2015, how would we be positioned today? And with the way the market took a downturn, how?
In aggregate, we probably had the same exposures, but we would have had lower transaction costs. So we're talking saving money on the margins here. With these first two line items, we're saving money on the margins. These are operational improvements, not move the needle kind of things. It just, before we start to talk about fully implementing FFP and moving the big blocks of money, we want to have the educational session on these items because these are what allow us to potentially do that more efficiently at lower cost.
I heard someone in our firm describe it once as, you look at your household budget, it's kind of like paying less for butter. Like, you want to pay less for butter, why wouldn't you? But at the in your budget, that's, it's not going to move the needle a lot. So, but we give a little bit of background more on the next couple pages. Cash equitization on page 10, I think we covered pretty well. Passive rebalancing on page 11 is the other one that is an example here of a much smaller plan, but looking at a $300 million portfolio, and this just walks through that hypothetical that they want to do a repositioning, and so we can take this $300 million portfolio that's 67% stocks and get it to 60% stocks by selling $21 million notional in stock futures and buying $21 million notional in bond futures to create that. And so this notional amount, again, is the economic reality of what we want to create in the portfolio, but the cash required to buy those futures is much less than the $21 million fraction of that. And then there is risks. Tracking error to the component benchmarks, of course. Small rebalances are fine. Larger adjustments tend to get a little bit out of whack. And within this process, with a futures contract, there are mark-to-market, daily mark-to-markets, and those kinds of things have to take place. So there are adjustments to the portfolio value every day to ensure that we are on track with either paying or receiving based on that economic reality. Page on duration matching, which I don't think is as important here. And then on page 14, some considerations. So selecting a service provider involves more than just an assessment of cost. Use of forwards and futures is important, so ability to access the forward market. So an important differentiator between forwards and futures is that you can go to the futures market and trade, and you're trading against a clearinghouse that will readily buy and sell to you from you. With forwards, it's an over-the-counter transaction where one party is making an agreement with another party. And so that there is no exchange involved in that transaction. It is just between the two parties. And they follow a standard agreement. So these transactions happen all the time throughout the day because they're all following the standard agreement. So they basically pre-agree to the agreement, and then they fill in their names and quantities, and the transaction happens. So that's all well orchestrated. That market has been in place, and those agreements have been in place dating back to 1985. So they have gone through some tumultuous market cycles and have been tested and edited and revised and tested and edited and revised. So it's a pretty solid contract, we believe, in today's day and age. So having managers who can access that is important. Now, also, whenever you have forwards and you're counteracting with another party, you have counterparty risk. Do they honor their contract? And so we want to have a manager capable of really assessing that counterparty risk, and also managers that are smart about diversifying their counterparty risk so that they're not solely engaged or principally engaged with just one other counterparty, that they've really spread it around. And so these are a couple of the other components that we'll bring to light as we would do a search for you and take a look at these details.
Presumably there's a transaction fee or commission or whatever on this kind of currency play.
Yes.
Is that competitive from one firm to another, or are they likely to give you a competitive proposal, or are they all charging the same flat fee?
They'll give us competitive proposals. Again, at the end of the day, it's going to be very thin differences between them.
This market has been largely commoditized. So, as Ed said, these are, you know, if you're trading futures, you're trading on an exchange. If you're trading forwards, these are highly, highly standardized.
Then how would a firm differentiate itself from another? Then, when you're trying to consider these firms, why not just pick one out of a hat?
Well, so that's what we're highlighting here. So,
Good segue.
Go to the hat slide.
Could you discuss next steps?
No, Jerry. It's a great question because we're saying costs are the easy statistic we can get from them all. But that's not going to tell us much more. This counterparty risk thing is important, and how they manage and measure that is really important. So we want to be aware of that and their access. Tracking error ties into costs a little bit, but we want to be sure that they're employing low tracking error strategies, meaning we're getting exactly what we ask them to buy, and then reporting. And so being able to just get transparency and understanding from them are some of the characteristics. So. I think Tim's right. It's largely a commodity business, but as we put together the providers, we'd want to see these stack up.
Service model. Service model is a big differentiator. Yeah.
Different kind of models.
I'm sorry?
Different than a beauty contest model.
It's a figure of speech.
So the firm that you're transacting with that's collecting the fee isn't necessarily your counterparty. They may be acting as truly an intermediary with some other firm. How transparent is it as to who you're actually entering into this contract with in order to be able to assess the counterparty risk?
So the counterparty risk is something that they'll have internally with their risk metrics, because they need to understand how much exposure they have. And what they do is a netting process where they take a look at all of their relationships with the other counterparty, and they can take all of those buys, sells, exposures and net them against each other. And that net number is what really matters. And actually, this is part of the evolution of the industry, is that netting concept wasn't enforced in past iterations of the contract. So it is now a netted exposure. So each of them can provide us with the net exposure that they have across their other counterparties. And so you can take it in total and you can see what percentage they have to the other ones.
But let's say we contract with, or we contact broker, these are prime brokers? Is that the term for these type of?
No.
That's commodity. That's commodity. Yeah. So we contact a firm. We want to buy, S&P future forward.
Mm-hmm.
They aren't necessarily the firm that we are going to enter into a contract with. They may be, but in all likelihood, they're acting as an intermediary, just a completely independent broker, and putting you into contact with, or trying to bring somebody that wants to sell S&P forwards, and you want to buy them together.
What kind of visibility do we have to the
as to who the true counterparty or counter contractee is with us?
So this would be part of the search, so that whenever we bring that back, we would show that to you, and we'd get comfort.
And that would be part of what I would think would differentiate firms, because some firms are going to try to make that relatively opaque and just present a solution to the client.
Right.
And others are going to be much more of an open book and saying, we built your portfolio this way, or we built your exposures this way. You have a 20% counterparty risk with JP Morgan, a 15% with HSBC. And we can see that, and we can have a conversation about how they vetted that. But that would be one of the differentiating factors between some of the shops, I think.
What's new for me is there's so much risk or possibility of corruption along the way. We're going another step where it'd be like backdoor deals going. So it's just new to me, how we're venturing out like that.
Think of it this way. You're doing this today, and you've been doing this for over a decade as part of the PIMCO Stocks Plus. This is precisely what PIMCO Stocks Plus does. It just writ large at the aggregate level. PIMCO buys forwards and swaps and options to gain the S&P 500 exposure in the future. They put up a small amount of capital to back that contract today. They invest the remainder of the pool of capital. So let's say they need $100 million of exposure. They put up $10 million of capital to back that today. They've got $90 million to invest. And then we have the conversation with PIMCO about what type of bond strategy we invest that 90% in. So this is something this board has been comfortable with on an individual portfolio basis. And we're trying to take some of those concepts that have worked for us on that strategy, strip out the active management of the collateral, and just talk about gaining these big block exposures cheaply and effectively. Well, you know, over the years, PIMCO Stocks Plus has had ups and downs in performance. The thing that's been a bright shining star is it's always the cheapest equity portfolio to us for us to transact in and out of, as close to zero as we get with anything. Because you're not trading physical securities, you're putting on exposures in the futures market and taking them off. Very inexpensive to do so.
You're going to headlights look.
Lots of process.
This is one of the, as Ed said, this is one of those things that helps us on the margins. We think it's a good operational tool. Most of, I won't speak to how many of your clients have it, but a lot of our peer systems around California have used this for the better part of 5 or 10 years. I haven't spoken with anybody who has regretted having it in place. They've always said it's been a useful tool, sometimes used, sometimes not, you know, but never has a negative value. Sometimes close to a zero value. Sometimes it's very valuable. But it's one of these things that's just a useful arrow in our quiver.
It's so, acceptable practice for a public pension
standard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just trying to pick up making our cash work for us in every respect, even if it's just a little slice.
Without having to transact in the physical market necessarily.
Okay.
So in the PIMCO model, our 90% that's not invested in the futures are invested in a bond portfolio.
Yeah.
What's the idea to do with the 90% that we don't have if we enter into these contracts, the 90%?
Invested in our main portfolio.
So we would want to create policy around that.
Right.
And we'd want to spec out that we want, we could provide guidance in the policy about the cash and acceptable targets and ranges and what to do if it gets above or below. And then we can also create policy around like the rebalancing opportunities and say, okay, we do want to use it for rebalancing, passive rebalancing, and here are the exposures we expect to get over a time frame. And then if we wanted to, I think that's probably where we want to stop. And depending on our experiences and everything there, we may then think about other uses for it in the future if we want to.
So you can do it on a completely unlevered basis by just leaving all the cash on the balance sheet.
Okay, that was my
idea. $200 million equity exposure backed by $200 million in cash, and you're accepting the variability on the future.
Okay.
And where is this policy going to be written? Is this part of the investment policy, or outside of it?
This would be structured closer to a traditional traditional manager contract, and policy statement would definitely be embedded in there as to what are the allowable uses of, on the manager side. But there would have to be something in the policy statement or a parallel document that says, from a CSERA perspective, are we going to back this 100% in cash, or are we going to allow some use of that? That would have to be, there would be a CSERA level document guiding that as well.
Do an addendum.
Probably.
You could have a cash overlay addendum to the IPS or something like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is this, Tim, something I'm looking at next steps now that you're seeking